quickly. My name is Doug Twiddell. I'm from the Beloit, Kansas congregation. And I apologize for the last minute bit of setup. This country boy had forgotten what city traffic was like, and so we misjudged the last minute rush hours home. I have a few hellos to pass along. Louise and Russell Hammer send their greetings to anyone that knows them from this area. They are back in Beloit. My grandfather, Twaddell, is ill, and they had flown back with the intention of being with my grandmother, so they are there. And I also send greetings from Edgar and Veronica Merrihue, who now live at Beloit, and they said that I should tell them hi, and I fortunately I didn't have anybody else, but I kept telling everybody at Beloit before we left, if everybody kept telling me to say hi to the people in California, I wouldn't have to talk, so come on. My subject this evening is the universe. Most of the material is taken from a compilation of thoughts of my own, scriptures I found as I've perused through materials, and statistics that I found both in books that I've looked at, and also from a talk that what spurred this whole thing was a talk, and I have borrowed some of his charts that Brother Edgar gave at Beloit. And as when they called me up to ask me to speak, the first thing that popped into my head was the subject of the universe and some of the thoughts that Brother Edgar had brought, and I've added to those and changed some things that I found, and I would encourage you, first of all, to find a book about astrophysics. That's the study of the stars and the planets and how they interrelate. Now, you have to be careful, I will tell you that right off the bat, because most of those books have some form of Big Bang theory or evolution placed in them. And you have to kind of weed through that. But you can pretty much trust that the facts and figures that they give you, other than things like ages and time spans and stuff like that, are mostly true. And I would like us to, first of all, if you would like to, turn to Psalms chapter 19. I've taken the topic from Psalms 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. We serve an awesome God, and the heavens truly do declare the glory of God, and I'd like to talk about that just a little bit. So if you look at Psalms chapter 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. Here we have a depiction of the sun, of the firmament, the space that we call the universe, out beyond where we can reach. And the idea of declaring is to make known, to proclaim. The best definition I found was to state in an unmistakable manner. There is absolutely no question. When you declare something, there is absolutely no question. And everything from the earth on the surface to the farthest star declares the glory of God. And that's part of what I want to speak to you about this evening. This causes this immense ability, a little behind, causes a never-ending speech or knowledge, completely never-ending. Think about how long the universe has stood, how long the moon has been there, how long the sun has come up and gone down. It's never-ending. The words of mankind come and go. Books that were popular 2,000, 3,000 years ago, not books probably, but sayings, are not popular now. They're not things we read. Things we read even a century ago sometimes are out of style. But the speech of the heavens never ends. It goes on. It says in verse 4, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Every human being has access. If somebody is alive, whether it was from Adam to us, all they had to do was look up in the stars and they could see this declaration. They could see this glory of God. Verse 6 says, its rising is from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. It's talking about the sun there. Think about that. There's nothing hidden from its heat. You know, we can go into our air-conditioned houses, but there's still heat on the house, isn't there? You have to keep running that air conditioning, because if you shut it off, pretty soon the house warms up. There's nothing. You can't get away from it. There's nothing hidden from its heat. If you look at Genesis chapter 1, it's not the warning bell, is it? Genesis chapter 1, verse 15 says, and let them, this is speaking when the creation was happening, when God was creating everything, he said, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. Here we have the purpose for all these lights, all these stars, to give light on the earth. And I'm going to dare to differ with you if you limit that to simply physical light so that we can see. They are a spiritual light also, because they declare the glory of God. They show us His handiwork. They spiritually light our life. The heavens declare the glory of God. Now, we're not going to have time to go into all the heavenly bodies. Okay? I think even if one of the speakers was presenting that for the 2 weeks, there wouldn't be time to go through all the heavenly bodies. But I would like to look at just a few of them. We'll start with the sun. The sun is an enormous monster compared to us. The sun is 865,000 miles in diameter. That's a hard number for us to swallow. So if you think about it this way, if you were to line up Earths side by side across to equal the diameter of the sun, you'd have to line up 108 of them side by side. It's a huge mass of stuff. The weight of it is 333,000 Earths. It's incredibly heavy. Its volume is 1 million times that of Earth. It's extremely large. It's made up of 90% hydrogen. 90% of it. The other 10% is mostly helium. And what that creates is a giant thermonuclear furnace. We know about fission. That's the atom bomb. That's the nuclear reactors that provide some areas of the country and the world with power. It's fission. They're splitting atoms. In the sun, the gravity is so dense that it actually makes new atoms by squashing some of them together. We can kind of do that because we have these things called particle accelerators. You've heard of those? But it takes literally months to get one set up, hours for it to work, till they can get it up to the speed and the angle where two atoms can collide, and they make about enough energy to light a match. We just can't do it. And here's why. Because the huge amount of heat, the core of the sun is approximately 15 million degrees centigrade. See, the reason we can't do what the sun does is because we can't hold it in. Nothing on this earth can withstand that kind of heat. It would melt. And then you would have a gone reaction and you'd blow up the world. So it'd be kind of pointless. Inside this heat, inside this furnace, it puts out 4 million tons of liquid helium per second. 4 million tons of liquid helium white hot liquid helium boils up to the surface as a result of these reactions. That's about 345 billion tons per day. Now, I know what some of you are thinking now. Well, at that rate, how long can she last? That's a lot of stuff. Well, scientists aren't positive, but they estimate that it should be able to continue doing what it's doing at the rate it's doing it for several hundred million years. That's how much stuff is in the sun. And what amazes me is that out of all that heat and light and energy coming from the sun, Earth receives less than 1/2 billionth of that output. That's what reaches us. Less than 1/2 billionth. I've got the remnants of a sunburn from Eminence. And it hurt. And I could feel the heat. Driving out here in the van, the sun was on my side driving, and my arm started to get warm. And there was a sun line right here across my elbow from the window. And I would reach over and I could touch my upper arm, and it was cool from the air conditioning hit it. And I touched my lower arm and it felt like it was going to burn my lips. But that's less than 1/2 billionth of the sun's energy. But you know what? It's exactly the right amount to support life here on Earth. Exactly the right amount. All of the Earth's energy, if you think about it, is nothing more than stored sunlight. All the natural fuels, the wind, the water, nothing is more than stored up sunlight ready to be used by us. No sun, no wind, no rain, no life. Any more or any less than that 1/2 billionth, and life ceases to exist. It's amazing, isn't it? The perfection. If we knew how delicately positioned and balanced our tiny little Earth was in relation to the sun, how the tilt of the Earth, if it moved just literally 1 or 2 degrees, would completely alter our life, probably destroy it. If we could see the molten lava underneath our feet and realize how thin that crust is that protects us from it, how thin it truly is, if we could feel the tremendous explosive forces that are present on the sun, we wouldn't sleep very well. Because it has to be an awesome and scary sight. If you believe that this all is happening, the sun was created and our Earth was placed exactly here to receive 1/2 billionth of that output, if you believe that was by chance, then you should worry. Because one little alteration and it's over. But if you believe that there's a God that created it to perfection, suspended the earth exactly in that point, at exactly that angle, then you don't have to worry at all. You don't have to spend even one sleepless night worrying about it. If you consider how important the sun is, then we have to appreciate the words of Psalm 84, verses 11 and 12. And I've taken sections of it here, but I'll read the entirety. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly. O Lord of hosts, blessed is the man who trusts in you. See, God is our sun, and he's our shield, and he's put a shield around the earth for us. The first shield we have, the first set of protection we have, is called the ionosphere. The ionosphere is the part of the atmosphere, the firmament around the earth that is furthest away from us. Okay? It is like it surrounds the earth and protects us from the sun's rays. See, that ionosphere, when we're angled a certain way, it glances some of the energy off and away. And when the sun's directly overhead, it allows more of it through. That's why it's hotter at noon than it is at sunrise or sunset. If the ionosphere wasn't there, we couldn't take the radiation. We couldn't stand the heat for 24 hours a day. The next shield he gives us is the atmosphere. That's the one we're most familiar with. That's the air that we breathe. Okay? The atmosphere is it gives us air to breathe. It's a warm blanket at night. It's amazing. The sunlight and the energy can come through the atmosphere easier than it can leave. Isn't that interesting? It traps the heat down here so that we don't freeze, but yet it lets some of it out so that we don't cook. See, it's perfect. It works exactly like it's supposed to. Plus, it shields us from the numerous meteors, comet debris, little pieces of stuff that's out there flying around that heads toward Earth. It completely burns it up before it ever can get to us. And you know, all those little pieces hitting us at 70,000 miles per hour, even the smallest one, as small as a grain of sand, would be like a high-powered rifle bullet going straight through us, right through our houses, right through our cars. The atmosphere burns them up before they can ever get to us. And very rarely does anything ever reach the Earth. Very rarely. You know, evolutionists claim that this just happened by chance. That this set of blankets above us is just an accident. I think I might know something that Jesus would say to them. I can picture him saying, "O ye of little faith." Or maybe, "O ye of no faith." Blessed is the man who trusts in God and trusts that he's able to be a shield to us. Well, let's talk about another member of our planetary system, Jupiter. Jupiter is a lot bigger than the Earth, but not as big as the Sun. Jupiter is about 89,000 miles in diameter, quite a bit bigger than us. Its volume is about 1,318 Earths. So it is a lot bigger than us, quite a bit. But it's also spinning much faster. It's on a 10-hour rotation around its axis. That means they have Jupiter has a 5-hour day and a 5-hour night. And we think time flies. A 5-hour day and a 5-hour night, which also means that the gravity is much more on Jupiter. Much more. Approximately 3 times as much. So if you weigh 200 pounds here on Earth, you'd weigh about 528 on Jupiter. If you just weigh 120 pounds on Earth, you'd weigh about 317 pounds on Jupiter. Jupiter's size and weight and huge amount of gravity allows it to do its job. Its job, and I'm going to put this chart up here. I didn't scan this one in because it was so large. But if you would like to come up and look at these charts that I have afterwards, you may. Jupiter is right here, and right in between Jupiter and Mars is what's called the asteroid belt. Oh, thank you. That's a good idea.
That's better.
Leave it to the elementary school teacher that uses charts. We band teachers just use blackboards. And its gravity and size allows it to hold all those right there in that orbit. They can't get away, which means they can't get to us. It collects all the junk that comes in from outside our solar system and puts it right in orbit and just holds it there. It doesn't let it escape. And its gravity is very useful to us because there's approximately, at any given time, about 50,000 pieces of rock that are following Jupiter around and that it's holding right there. And any one of those is large enough. Many of them are as large as the United States. And if that hit our planet, we'd be gone. But God put Jupiter in exactly the right spot, with exactly the right size, with exactly the right gravitational pull, that it can hold these objects in orbit and we don't have to worry a bit about them. We simply don't have to worry about them. We talked about the gravity. Maybe you'd rather go to the evening star planet. Venus, whatever you weigh now, you'd weigh about 20% less on Venus. Maybe you like that a little better. But if you were to go to the sun, you'd weigh about 28 times what you weigh now. That means most of us guys would weigh more than our cars. It's a lot of weight. Jupiter obviously has a larger orbit around the sun. Jupiter's year is equal to about 12 of our years. Where we take 1 year to travel around the sun, Jupiter takes 12. Just because it's so far away. Pluto, way out on the outskirts of our solar system, takes about 248 Earth years to go around the sun. It is a very long way away. In fact, it's so far away that if you had a friend, this is totally hypothetical, but if you had a friend on Pluto, and you were here and you called them up, from the moment you finished asking them a question, it would take about 8 hours to hear their reply. We call around the world almost instantaneously, and it would take 8 hours to visit with Pluto. Now, there are thousands of other things about our solar system that declare the glory of God. There are probably many more things that we don't even know about. I'm convinced that just within our solar system, we don't know a whole lot more than we know. But our solar system is a picture of beauty. If we could miraculously fly out into space and look back on our solar system, we would be amazed at how spectacular it is, how timely and precise everything works together, how the gravitational forces interplay with each other to hold everything in line, how complex and involved it really is, how fast everything is moving and yet nothing goes wrong, and we would probably be surprised that nothing ever goes wrong. You know, there's scientists that do worry something will go wrong. They want to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on equipment and technology that would be able to intercept and destroy and avoid a collision between one of those pieces of rock that Jupiter's hanging in place. They're afraid one of them will come flying out of orbit and crash into us and destroy us. I'd rather see us spend that $100 billion in a lot better ways and leave the comets and asteroids and meteorites up to God. I know a man, I want to tell you this quick little story, and I wasn't going to tell you who this was, but since most of you know him, it's Brother Edgar. He worked for many years in the defense industry, and his main job there was grinding out financial and scheduling data for the company. And management depended very heavily on the computer systems that they had to come up with all this data. And they never had any problems getting priority status on the computers, because all they had to do was tell the computer department, look, management needs this. If they don't get it and they yell at us, we're going to tell them it's your fault. And they instantly gained access. But then the company became the prime contractor for the first soft landing equipment for a lunar mission called the Surveyor program. Some of you may remember that. All of a sudden, the engineering and math departments became immensely important. And some of the trajectory calculations, he said, took almost 24 hours on the computer. And they would recalculate them and recalculate them and recalculate them thousands of times to make sure they were correct. He was in the computer room several times when they were processing these numbers, and he noticed that it was continually spitting thousands of sheets of paper out of 12 different printers constantly, 24 hours a day, with these figures and equations. And he said something to one of the project managers about what a waste of paper, what a waste of time. And the engineers summarily informed him that it was not a waste of time. He said that they never read a line of it unless a wrong answer came up. And then they would comb through every single line of those thousands and thousands of sheets of paper until they found the mistake. And Edgar noticed that many days and nights, those engineers were there 24 hours a day trying to figure out what the problem was. They came to realize that it was no easy task to shoot a rocket from a platform moving 1,000 miles per hour to a target 250,000 miles away that was also moving 2,255 miles per hour. They decided that wasn't as easy as it sounded. My question is, if that was so great a problem, think about what kind of incredible mind it must have taken to set the entire universe into motion with the exact figures, the exact sizes, the exact distances it took so that nothing ever went wrong. What an incredible intellect that God must have. The heavens declare the glory of God. We've mentioned it briefly, but I'd like to talk about a little bit more about our speed. How fast are we traveling? On the way out here, I don't know how many times I heard, are we at California yet? Would anybody like to guess how fast we've been traveling for the last 2 hours? Not including those of you teenagers that were on the interstate getting here. Take your pick. I have both. We have been rotating. In the last 2 hours, we have traveled about 2,000 miles. Didn't even know it. That's just in our spinning, on our own axis. If you take into account going around the sun, we've traveled about 134,000 miles. That's about 64,000 miles an hour. Most of us get a little nervous at 100. Now think about, take into account how fast are we moving throughout the universe. How fast are we spinning in our soul, in our own Milky Way galaxy? How fast is our Milky Way galaxy spinning around all this other stuff? And we're going to get to that later. But we are traveling enormously fast. Until now, we've looked only at how the heavens declare the glory of God, mostly within our own solar system. But to be quite honest, what's beyond our solar system is even more amazing to me. More intriguing. We've read in Genesis chapter 1 about the creation of the lights in the firmament, the stars that were placed in the sky to give us light. As I read Genesis, I continually receive the message in my little brain that amongst all these stars, God has given the earth preeminence. God, we're not the center of anything. You ever think about that? Earth is not the center of anything that spins except itself. But yet we are the most important thing in the universe, planetarily wise. And amazingly to me, when God was finished with this earth, that he made more important than anything else in the universe, he gave it to us. He said, go at it. Take care of it. To me, that shows the amazing amount of confidence and love that God has in us. The things he knows we can accomplish, and the love that he has for us. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, if you'd like to turn to that, there's some scriptures that I didn't put up on the overhead because I wanted you to make the effort to turn to it and read it. Hebrews chapter 11. We're familiar with this chapter. At the beginning of it, he says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good testimony. By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible. The Apostle Paul chooses the description of the creation of the universe to open up this chapter on faith. To me, that shows how important the creation and the stars and the heavenly bodies were to Paul in his faith in God. How important a piece of the puzzle they were. The emphasis that he makes on it. So it talks about the hosts. How many is there? What exactly does hosts mean? Oh, there's all our information earlier. Psalms 33 and 6 says, "By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and all the hosts by the breath of his mouth." How many are there? Well, astronomers estimate, and here I would like to insert estimate and emphasize that word, they estimate that there are several hundred billion stars just in our Milky Way galaxy. On top of that, they estimate that there are billions of galaxies in the universe. When God talks about the hosts of them, that's what he means. That's the kind of numbers that he's thinking. Brings home the fact in Isaiah 40, chapter 26, who brings out their hosts by number and calls them by name. He knows the name. You know what? I look at a star chart and I see galaxy 1.99654. Because we can't even come up with enough names to call them. We can't even begin to fathom how many there really are. And yet God calls them by name. He knows them. So where are we? In this huge myriad of stars, where are we? Well, this next chart comes to us thanks to National Geographic. And again, I would like to point out, if you'd like to come up and look at it closer afterwards, you can. Good, I was hoping the laser pointer was still here. This chart shows very clearly our place in the grand scheme of the universe. It's a series of cylinders that fall in upon one another to show us where we're at. And thanks to David, we were able to scan sections of this into the PowerPoint, so you will be able to see some of it better than others. Cylinder number one, right here, is our solar system, our sun and its planets. We've so far been measuring distances in miles. Within our solar system, we can kind of comprehend numbers of miles between planets, between stars, and diameters and densities and all that. But from this point on, we have to switch to something called light years. I never really understood what a light year was. I knew the definition, the amount light travels in 1 year. I knew that. But light travels 186,000 miles per second. 186,000 miles per second. That's about 6 trillion miles per year. So when somebody says a light year, they're talking about 6 trillion miles. Okay? Now take a good look at that, because we're about to become infinitely small. We go from cylinder number one to cylinder number two. Our sun right there, that is our solar system, with 20 of our closest stars. We almost disappear already. Just 20 of our closest stars. The closest of these is Alpha Centauri, which is 4.3 light years close. That's about 25 trillion miles away. And people think someday we'll travel there. I know people used to say we would never go to the moon, but I'm not sure we'll make it to Alpha Centauri. Again, take a really good look, because our sun and their closest and its 20 closest neighbors are again about to become infinitely small. We are about to... We take up a lot of space. We really do. On this chart, this outer line represents about 20 light years from the center, which is our sun right now. About 20 light years. That means it's about 40 light years across. That's a lot of space, plus some depth, if you notice. But we're about to get lost, completely lost. We talk about the Milky Way galaxy, and a lot of times we almost refer to it as it's just this small little area that we call home. This is the Milky Way galaxy. It's about 10,000 light years in diameter and about 10,000 light years thick. It's shaped like a spiraling discus. And here we are in the third radial arm known as Sagittarius, and that is our 20 closest neighbors. We have just become unimportant. We don't mean much as far as the universe goes. We're just kind of there. Now, I know that you're looking at that and thinking, that looks kind of crowded, doesn't it? All those stars floating around? Looks kind of crowded. There are literally, according to estimates, trillions and trillions of light years between each of those galaxies, each of those stars, in some cases. There's a lot of empty space. A lot of empty space. Some of those stars, some of these other stars in our galaxy are millions and millions of times larger than our sun. You thought our sun was big, and they're just so much bigger. There's stars out there that are hundreds of thousands of times as large as our solar system. And God made every one of them. Now, I know you may be thinking at this point, Doug, do you really believe those numbers? Yes, I do. Man has made tremendous advancements in all the fields of knowledge in the last century, especially in mathematics and astrophysics. With the help of modern technologies and computer systems that can crunch these huge numbers, they've been able to calculate some of these things. And as we probe deeper and deeper into space, we're going to find out even more that we didn't ever know. And I will agree that those figures could be wrong. They're all estimates, or maybe better phrased, guesstimates. But if anything, I'm convinced that those figures are actually too small, not too big. Because I think sometimes we can't quite calculate how big everything really is. And there's no doubt in my mind that God has the wisdom, the power, and the ability and the knowledge to create that. There is no doubt in my mind. Now, just like the moon orbits the earth every 29 and a half days, just like the earth travels the sun in about every year, the sun is in orbit around our galaxy. Anybody want to venture a guess on how long it would take us to get from there all the way around and back to there? The best estimate anybody can come up with is about 230 million years. That's how big our Milky Way galaxy is. It's enormous. And if the universe ended right here with our galaxy, we would agree that God has performed a tremendous task in creating that. But we're just getting started. In the next cylinder, this is where we kind of had to cut and paste a little. If you look at that cylinder, it's going to be sucked in to right there. That is our Milky Way galaxy, with 20 of the closest neighboring galaxies. They call it the local group. Group is a little far-fetched because of the space involved between those things, and local is even more far-fetched. I think of local as not long-distance phones. And then finally, we can't even get this on the screen. And I told David, I said, that just proves that computers aren't as good as they think they are. And I apologize. Brother Edgar said to tell everybody he's sorry that their basement leaks a little. And the top of this chart is a little bit destroyed. But here is what scientists call the known universe. And I want to emphasize the word known, because I'm firmly convinced that there's a lot more out there that we don't know about than there is that we do. Here, I'm sorry, I skipped one. Our local group, sorry, goes into our, our supercluster, thank you. I'm sitting here with a science teacher up a row. Oh, she has the same chart. That's even more dangerous. This is our local supercluster, okay? And here, our local group is still just a medium-sized dot, isn't it? It's still almost not there. There's a lot of unknowns that remain. And then that supercluster siphons right in to the known universe. And isn't it interesting that man, in this chart, has placed our Earth and our Sun at the middle of our 20th closest neighbors. They know too much to place it at the center of our solar system, of our galaxy. They know too much to place it at the center of our local supercluster. They know too much, or our local group, they know too much to put it at the center of our local supercluster, but yet they've put it at the middle of the galaxy. The galaxy is enormous. We can't even hardly comprehend the amount of light years. On this chart, it has 20 billion light years from the center. 40 billion light years across. And quite frankly, that's a number I don't believe is true. Because again, I believe there's a lot more out there that we don't know about than we do. But you know what? That entire magnificent, enormous universe was placed there. Why? To put light upon the earth. The focus of the entire universe, the light, the energy, the power that's behind it, centers right down to our earth so that the heavens can declare the glory of God. As huge as this is, I couldn't help, the whole time I was putting this lesson together, but to think about Isaiah chapter 40. If you'd like to turn there, it's another one I didn't put up on the chart because I think it's extremely important to read this section. Isaiah chapter 40. And we'll start with verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as a counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge? Who showed him the way of understanding? Think about that verse. How much water can you measure in the hollow of your hand? And yet God can hold all the waters of the earth right there. How much dust can you manage to measure? It says God knows that much. Just like we'd measure flour to make a cake. He measured the dust of the earth. The balance. And then the part that we're most concerned about tonight, he measured heaven, the heavens, with a span. With a span. When God was creating the universe, he went about that much. How awesome God is. How amazingly huge and enormous and powerful and intelligent. The heavens declare the glory of God. And the firmament shows his handiwork. Again, I'd like you to turn to Psalms chapter 8. This is another verse that just kept popping up in my mind. Psalm 8, verses 3 through 5. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the work of his fingers, all this stuff, the work of his fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him? And the Son of Man that you visit him? For you have made him a little lower than the angels, and you have crowned him with glory and honor. In all this stuff that we call the universe, size-wise, we are nothing. It was said this morning in our devotional, looking out from space at our planet, we can't say, there I am. It's too far away. We're even smaller from the edge of the universe. And yet God is mindful of me. God is mindful of you. He cares. The end of that passage, it says, he crowned with glory and honor. He gave the earth to us. What an awesome gift. And then turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. We've been talking about the immense mass that's in the universe, the size, where we fit in, how much is out there, how fast is it going? But look at 2 Peter chapter 3, starting with verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Imagine. The sun, at its core, is 15 million degrees centigrade. And the heat that's coming is going to melt it. It's going to burn it up. All this is just going to be gone. It's going to pass away with a great noise and melt with fervent heat. Verse 11. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heaven and a new earth. In which righteousness dwells. See, even though all this is going to be melted away, God is mindful of man. And all he asks is that we follow his word. That we simply do what he asks us to do. Now think about something for a second. Think about how complex the universe is. And I know there's debates over, did God create it and just step back and let it go? Or did he create it? Is he constantly holding everything where it's supposed to be? I don't know. But you know what matters to me is that with all that power, think about now how simple His plan of salvation is for man in comparison. That one, the Son of God, would come down and die. And all we have to do is believe and follow Him. It's all we have to do. And it seems difficult to us. It seems complex. From God's way of thinking, if the universe He could speak into existence, He must look down and wonder why we can't manage such a simple task. But God is mindful of man. He even says here that we should look forward to the day of the Lord. We should look forward to the day when all this just melts and is gone. But we can only look forward to it if we've followed His commands. If we've believed on Him and repented and been baptized. That is the only way. It's a simple plan. We talk about it all the time, the simple plan of salvation and how truly simple it is. And yet we fail to do it. When the elements melt away, I still believe that that won't be anything like the fires of hell. We talked about it today in classes, that God's language to our language, He struggles to describe. And what He came up with to describe hell to us was fire and brimstone. And I think that's pretty light compared to what it will be. If He can create a sun that's 15 million degrees centigrade, if He can create other suns that are millions of times larger than that, and if He can create enough heat to melt it all away in a snap, that's a far cry. But at the same time, He says, when it's gone, there will be a new heaven and a new earth. If God could create this heaven and this earth, imagine what the new one's going to be like. What happens when you create one thing and you decide to make it better and you do it again? How much better it is. God's going to create a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And you can be there. You can live there. You can understand what it's like to be in the presence of God if you'll accept Him. The heavens truly do declare the glory of God. The firmament shows His handiwork. And if you can't see it, and you can't listen to it, I don't know what you can listen to. Be ready to look forward to the day of judgment. Don't be caught unprepared for the day when the heat is so intense that it melts our sun. If you're ready to accept Christ tonight, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the song that's been announced.